And this is KAZU-FM in Pacific Grove, California. It's Mae Brussel, and it's broadcast number 638. It's February the 27th, 1984. I have to think about that date again. Those months go very fast, too fast for me. Last year at this time, February the 28th, 1983, there was a one-day difference there. Broadcast number 586, we were talking about a very interesting web of connections that has a history going way back into the political spectrum and on into our future. It had to do with the death of Mr. Charles Bluedorn, age 56, who was the president of Gulf and Western, who came from Vienna, and I did a broadcast on Mr. Bluedorn's background. And then the connections of Mr. Bluedorn to Michael Sindona of the Vatican, God's banker, who's in a federal penitentiary right now for bank problems and wanted in Italy on a murder charge for having a hitman, we'll go into him in a second, to kill an investigator in Milan, one of a few. And the links of Dominican Republic to Mr. Bluedorn and to Ronald Reagan's career, and to Mr. Wasserman of Music Corporation of America, and the interconnecting links of the Gulf and Western and Paramount Studio and Kirk Kerkorian, who's now at MGM, and the early Ronald Reagan career with Music Corporation of America and Sonny Werblin of the Madison Square Garden, the CIA, the Vatican, the Dominican Republic, the GOP, the Richard Nixon, Ronald Reagan, money, the money tree, and the interconnection of these various people between Vienna, Germany, Hollywood, and Rome. Their relationship, these huge corporations, tied in to these presidents, Richard Nixon and Ronald Reagan and the Republican Party. Then also, I talked about Mr. William Taub, whose biography is in the autobiography, The Forces of Power. Some of these broadcasts that I do, these back broadcasts, are very important connections to other news events that take place in the future or to the past history of these particular countries and candidates. And often when a person dies, like Mr. Bluedorn, his multifaceted career comes out and jumps at you. You're not aware of it until the obituaries start rolling in, and then the cities where he lived and where he got his money and so forth comes out. It's not in the who's who, and you don't seem to, I don't look up each individual person as they come along. And then all of a sudden, these wonderful obits, the New York Times is great at it, and also the Reverend Moon paper, the DC Times. And then you get where they met with other important actors on the stage concerning our history, our political history. So that broadcast was a very important one because with the background of Mr. Bluedorn, it opened up a lot of avenues of connecting links of the politicians and the drug connections and the mafia connections and the church and Hollywood and so forth. Now, this morning I talked to Larry Flint. 6 in the morning the phone rang and it was Larry. I'm briefly going to tell you what's happening in the Larry Flint publications, because many of you have followed this week by week, and you know my role of pulling back until I could make some sense about the people there and see that they were cleaned out, or else I would just not participate in what was going on. Larry is in North Carolina, Durham, North Carolina. He sounded great. It was the first time that we had a chance to talk about some of the people that surrounded him and came into his life and did so much harm to him. I didn't bring up the subject, but I decided that I wouldn't send in any manuscripts until we personally could go over, as each person entered the life, what happened. Because if he doesn't understand what happened to him, then he can't take care of his future, and I'm not going to be associated with those kind of people. But right now, everything that should happen is happening around him. That is good. In the first place, Marvin Miller, the publisher, has now become vice president of the Flint publication. Now, Marvin Miller published that marvelous book, The Breaking of the President. I don't know how many of you have it. It's an 800-page book on Watergate. It is absolutely the best book on Watergate there is. He put out many publications on the Kennedy assassination and on Kennedy. He's a publisher who has been made vice president of the Flint organization. And I don't know him personally, but I know his track record of what he got out. And it couldn't be better to have him in control right there with if Larry's going to be away. Also working there is Art Kunkin, who wrote the book, The Breaking of the President. Larry wanted Art to be there when the Rebel came out to work on the Rebel, and he wasn't there when it started. He came up to Carmel and spent about 3 days with me over New Year's before he went down to L.A. Then he went to Springfield to see Larry. He's going to get out. It was the Los Angeles Free Press. Art got that out for 10 years. He was at the original press conference I had with my Watergate story and covered it in those days. We've been friends for a long time, and he's a very solid, reliable person. And he's going to start the free press that Larry has on a daily newspaper basis, and I will probably be writing up what I have on World Watchers in the evening on Monday night, and then write it up Tuesday and have a column weekly in the free press. Larry is going on with the Rebel. There is money put into the Flint organization with Art there and Marvin Miller, and the Rebel will continue. I thought it would go as a monthly. He wants a weekly, and he wants me to do an article a week. I can't do a newspaper article and a Rebel article and a Hustler ghostwriting for him, so I will have to juggle it around. As much as I want to write, he wants to take, and that is fine. We had a long talk about some of the people that entered his life. He's afraid of them. He's afraid he'll be killed. One in particular he told me about. And then I finally understood how all of these people surrounded him, because the subject of one of these particular parties came up, his name. And he learned that his telephone had been tapped for the past 12 years. And when I first called Larry Flint's offices and offered to do a story on Larry McDonald, when that plane crash went down at Western Gold, Larry called me, and then he had me talking on the telephone to various people at his home and movie director and different people, and he'd call and ask me about certain characters, and I would warn him and tell him, and they, as I told you many times, they would enter his life. Well, the telephones were tapped. Our conversations were tapped, and everybody I warned him about was invited into the home, into the mansion, and they did everything to separate his opinion of me, even turn in reports that I was with the KGB. But the point is that these people, for all purposes, have splintered off and left. And I've had their names on the air almost every week. You know who they are. He's, as I say, afraid of particular people. They have I know, he didn't tell me this, but I know one of them bragged about certain people he had killed. And as far as Gordon Novell is concerned, Bob Cutler wrote an article that he was played a part in killing John Kennedy. So we've had that on the air. But I can see now that what they did was they took conversations that we had and then smothered him, literally smothered him with his enemy. He has a good mind, and he seems clear, and I think he appreciated the fact that when all of this was coming down, this confusion, that I simply pulled back and just withdrew from the entire thing and didn't submit anything and won't send anything, and now it's in good hands. So it's a question of a tug of war, a possible coup there. The whole thing could have been collapsing. But things seem to be in good hands with Marvin Miller and particularly Art Kunkin. And here are two wonderful people with a wonderful track record. And so pretty soon I've been collecting stuff and ready to send in manuscripts so I can roll along, and I have more than I can handle. If I want to do it, I can do as much as I want. Just briefly, I do want to mention one more time that Women's Week all over the country next week, Women's History, and I will be at De Anza College, 10:30 to 12 o'clock, that's 280 Stevens Creek Boulevard. Somebody called me today and wanted to know what I was going to talk about. I'm not going to talk about John Kennedy or Robert Kennedy. I'm going to talk about women. It's Women's Week and research and some of the personal things, off the record, things I can't say on the air, all you want to know about Mae Brussel. We'll talk about a woman's problems and the pleasures and the things that you confront in doing investigative journalism or just trying to be a parent and doing research at the same time and juggling these worlds, because there's a lot of different aspects that enter into any field when you are separated psychologically from the home and you have a particular job you're doing and then the home besides. But I think doing the political research complicates it in a way that people enter your home that can be helpful and can be harmful, and you're really out there with all kinds of questionable spies, friends, enemies. Will they hurt you? Will they poison you? How you get together and so forth. So we'll talk about that. There's a new book out called The Ultimate Seduction by Charlotte Chandler, and it caught my eye. I'll have to get this one for Mother's Day or birthday this year. It's about people in their workplace, and it has some quotations just in the blurb of the book. Tennessee Williams saying, "What I learned in life is that only dreams are true." And The Ultimate Seduction is the learning that work can take you away from a lot of other things, and that work becomes your play, and that play, doing the work, is more fun. What people think is a lot of work is really your play, and how you get pulled into the thing, which takes so much of your time, and the more time you have, the more fun you spend. This has been the case for me. I never get tired of research, and I get tired of seeing people or being with people who aren't doing it, and when I'm with people who do it, it's really stimulating and fun. And so The Ultimate Seduction was finding something I liked and going with it. And there's no such thing as poor me, she's working too hard. The real agony is when I'm not doing what I'm doing, and I really love it. And the trick is to find the thing you like and then to do that. So I'm anxious to read that book, and I will meet people up at Dan's and we'll have time to answer any questions you want. This week, on the 29th, it's the February 29th, this is leap year. On the 29th of 1972, journalist Jack Anderson published the Dita Baird memo. I mentioned it on the talk part of the program last week, but not on the World Watchers. That was the time when he mentioned that the government would drop the antitrust suit against ITT in exchange for $400,000 donation that John Mitchell would get to the Republican National Convention. John Mitchell being both the campaign raiser, fundraiser, and the attorney general. And when that story broke, February 29th, 1972, in February, that was just beginning of March, the Republican committee got caught in such a tangle with ITT and the hotel and the convention in San Diego that they had to swing it, the convention to Miami, and then they only had 1 month up till April to get all the money in they needed to have the riots that the Republicans planned with provocateurs in Chicago in 1968, so that all the plans for the riots or the plans to kill Richard Nixon and make Agnew president fell through, and the only way they could get Nixon out of office and put in Alexander Haig as chief of staff and Nelson Rockefeller as vice president, and then Gerry Ford from the Warren Commission in, appointed as president by Richard Nixon. They slid him out by having those tapes that Alexander Butterfield, along with Haig knew about it. They were taping the president, and then they just slid him out of office on the basis of the tapes that they leaked and didn't have to tell. And the power shifted to the Rockefeller, Ford, Haig combine and got Tricky Dick out of office. So he slid out of office, and Agnew then was pushed out. Before Nixon went, he made sure Agnew went first. And Watergate was a manipulated process, which didn't have to be done by a bullet. The power did shift at that time. But it all began to fall apart because of Jack Anderson's column about the Dita Baird memo. There's a story in today's paper that made me simply furious, but it's more of the same a la Watergate. USIA, the U.S. Information, the broadcasting for our CIA, the council destroyed the files that tie Mr. Wick and his aides to the blacklisting. Now, they had a meeting and decided, the meeting was February the 4th, and the acting deputy director, Leslie Lenkowski, met with Thomas E. Harvey, a CIA counsel, and John Mosher, the director of the program, and they decided, or Lenkowski decided, Leslie Lenkowski, to just destroy the papers that they decided as part of the strategy for dealing with the anticipated press was to destroy the papers. Now, at the time of Watergate, nobody was charged with destroying evidence. And when you don't charge them with destroying evidence, I talked about this last week with Robert Kennedy's clothing or the clothing of Mayor Moscone or Harvey Milk in San Francisco, the coroner wants to destroy the clothing. When you destroy evidence in trials, if you allow it once, it happens again. At the time of Watergate, the shredders were going at the committee to reelect the president. E. Howard Hunt's desk was emptied out of the White House and contents could be destroyed. They went to the home of James McCord and destroyed his files right away. And even the acting director of the FBI, L. Patrick Gray, was told to Deep Six to throw into the river some of the papers. So that there were fires, and Charles Colson had asked Gordon Novell to erase the White House tapes, everything they could scramble on and destroy. They still had impeachment procedures that they didn't go through to remove Nixon, and they should have gone through them. So the USI takes their papers and destroys them, and that should never be allowed. And yet today they said, well, that's all we could do is destroy them, and that's what the coroner said in San Francisco about the clothing that would be destroyed that could put Dan White back in prison. I think something has to be done about that, but I don't know what we can do. Now, I got an article from the Houston Post about a man who died. He fell out of the ninth floor of the federal prison in New York City. I've mentioned his name many times on the air, and I can't figure out why none of my papers have had this story. If you've seen it, send me a copy of your paper. I haven't seen it in the Washington Post or the New York Times. Maybe you've seen it. I haven't. This is the way it reads in the Houston Post. Inmate killed in plunge. Now, it isn't an Associated Press or UPI story. It's the Houston Post News Service. Hitman suspect dies in escape try in New York prison. An inmate suspected of being the hitman for Italian financier Michael Sindona fell to his death trying to escape from the ninth floor of a federal prison. He had sheets he was going to tie together like Tarzan. Can you imagine how many sheets it would take to get out of the ninth floor of a federal prison in New York City? Now, this fellow, the story jumps from his prison try down to Tennessee where prisoners are out, down to Mexico where prisoners are out, which has nothing to do with this fellow. He fell out of this building. It's a 12-story jail building in Lower Manhattan. Then Mr. Orrico, this is William Orrico that we've talked about many times. He's the fellow that was also in a jail before and left in New York City and then was picked up at Bucks County, Pennsylvania, just at the time that Grace Kelly died and that the family from Lockheed were killed in former president of Lockheed was killed in Philadelphia, and out of Bucks County came this assassin hitman for the Vatican, and all of a sudden he was picked up. He was supposed to be sent to Italy. This article says the Justice Department began seeking court approval last December to extradite Orrico and Sindona to Italy, where they were accused of the 1979 murder in Milan of Giorgio Ambrosoli. I did several broadcasts on Ambrosoli, and you can get those if you want. That's at the time that he was killed. And I mentioned those broadcasts. One was, if you want to look them up and have them, 414 and 426 were the time that he was killed. He was a lawyer liquidating one of the banks of Sindona's that collapsed. This man would be a primary witness as the hitman to Michael Sindona, God's banker, and all of a sudden, out of the ninth floor, he goes flying out in New York City and is killed. If you have any articles on him, send them to me. As far as I can see, as of this date, I haven't seen them in the newspaper. And if she didn't send this to me, I wouldn't have even known that this primary witness was killed at this time. I think many of you who listen every week can see how these witnesses get off, and we'll talk about another one in a few moments that also died this week. Several weeks ago, I talked about Harry Schlotterman, who was going to be our next ambassador to Guatemala, and the role he played in Chile when Allende was murdered. And he's been our ambassador to Argentina, Peru, Venezuela, Dominican Republic. He was on the committee for Henry Kissinger as the official to help do research into Central America. And of course, you know what kind of a job they did. They used certain people as a cover for the committee until Kissinger could ask for his $8 billion right away for some more bloodbaths. Now, Richard B. Stone, the ambassador at large, was on that special committee, and Stone was there for one purpose. When it was appointed last April, people objected to Henry Kissinger's committee, so Richard Stone from Florida was appointed for the purpose of demonstrating that the Reagan administration was willing to seek negotiations for peace in Central America. So Stone was appointed to defuse the charges of the congressional Democrats that the administration was ignoring the possibility for peace and opting for war. So as soon as the commission was closed and the money started rolling in and the Congress said, yeah, we'll give it to you, then Stone resigns his role of ambassador at large and Mr. Schlottermann comes in to take over the committee. Not only the divesting of the money, but he's the ambassador at large for Central America, which is horrendous. Now, if you want any references on Mr. Schlottermann, I gave you some before on his past history, which is horrendous, you can get the book Assassination on Embassy Row, and in that book it tells you of his role with Michael Townley. Townley, who was an American who came from Detroit and worked for Ford Motor and NASA, was behind hiring the assassins for Orlando Letelier. And when the assassins were in Europe, before they came to the United States, had left Chile, they stopped in Munich, where the DINA, that's the private police of Salvador Allende, the DINA cultivated contacts with Nazi sympathizers and with Christian Social Union leader Franz Josef Strauss. So before they came to the United States, they stopped in Vienna and refreshed their friendship. And then this book on the death of Orlando Letelier, Assassination on Embassy Row, tells about the Vernon Walters and his role in the CIA in killing Letelier and their role with Pinochet and with Harry Schlottermann. And it tells about Ambassador Landau's cable regarding these two men that were going to come into this country and kill Letelier and Ronnie Moffat. At the State Department, the book says, the cable reached the office of Harry Schlottermann, Assistant Secretary of State for Inter-American Affairs, first arriving at the office of Secretary of State Henry Kissinger. They were thick with the Waffen-SS, with the Nazis in Vienna, with the assassins of other administrations, and worked with George Bush and Henry Kissinger, and there are a lot of references in the book, The Assassination on Embassy Row. They even refer to a Cuban exile and the Waffen-SS, the CIA, and Mr. Schlottermann, and this is a part of our Central American policy. This particular thing has to do with Orlando Letelier and Ronnie Moffat, but has to do with our Vice President, George Bush, who works with these Nazis, with Ambassador George Landau. Now, looking up the Schlottermann information, I read a section in one of the books on George Landau. Our ambassador to Chile at the time was, would you guess, from Vienna, just like Mr. Blue Dorn and a lot of other people. He came over like Henry Kissinger or Peter Drucker into Army intelligence just before the war was over, and then as our ambassador to Chile when the Nazis were put in power, working with Paraguayan President Stroessner and the Nazis in South America. Mr. Schlottermann has a history of blood. He started with the Guatemala coup that involved Friedrich Schwen, that Frank Bender, worked with the Nazis in Europe, in Vienna, with the Central Intelligence Agency. In the book Death in Washington by Don Fried, he has a section on Michael Townley and Mr. Schlottermann and the bloodbath, and he refers to Harry Schlottermann, who joined the State Department in 1954, serving as a counselor officer in Colombia until 1956. After language training, he moved in 1959 to Bulgaria. He's best known for the key role he played in the Dominican Republic in the mid-1960s. That, again, is the Charles Blue Dorn, Nixon-Reagan coup down in the Dominican Republic. And the whole network of the Vatican and the Nazi and the United States intelligence operation, that's where he was. He was transferred to the position of second in command in Santiago, Chile, in June of 1969. Don Fried's book refers to Harry Schlotterman. We've talked on the telephone about how this guy has worked his way up from everywhere, from Guatemala, the Dominican Republic, and with these various coups, with George Bush, with the CIA, with the Nazis, and so forth. And then in the book Labyrinth, a new book out on the Chilean murders and the CIA and the death squads, it's put out by Mr. Branch and Mr. Proper, that's the latest book, they refer to Mr. Schlotterman's role working with the men who took their Chilean passports and traded them to be from Paraguay. And those are the fellows that went to Europe to visit with the Nazis in Vienna and Germany and then came to Washington, D.C. It was in that book where they referred to Ambassador Landau, who was a native of Vienna, Austria, who adopted the United States as his country, fought against Hitler as a draftee in the American Army, and with his slight German accent and World War II background in Army intelligence, he served in a country like Paraguay, and then he went on to Chile. If we read the background of more of these people, we'll see that just when the war was winding down, they came into the United States Army intelligence under the guise of fighting Hitler when Hitler already knew the war was over and was incorporating these people with Martin Bormann and starting the Fourth Reich. So they looked like they fought Hitler, but they were getting their foot in Europe to meet with the top Nazis when the war was over and know where the documents were and the money was to begin the Fourth Reich. In fact, Landau was stationed as a CIA officer, and this book refers to his station work that goes back to his first post in Uruguay, where the station chief of the CIA was E. Howard Hunt. So you get E. Howard Hunt with these people in the Guatemala invasion, of course, the Bay of Pigs, and up through the Watergate, and goodness knows what they're doing right now, forging State Department documents at the time of Watergate and so forth. So what you have here is a history of people. Schlotterman supposedly comes from UCLA, from Southern California. But Landau, who you wouldn't suspect, again, is the Austrian who's put an American uniform. And let me make that clear one more time. If you read any biographies or books or history books, and you find these names of these financiers with this profile, copy the pages of the book and send them to me with the front page and the author and the editor, and photocopy these huge multinational people. The pattern seemed to be this. There were several patterns. One, that they came over from Vienna like Helene von Damm, and they go to Detroit, then to Chicago, and then there's usually Texas, New Jersey, and there's Houston, Texas, and New Jersey, and then they splinter up. They usually hit two or three of those cities, starting with Detroit and Chicago, or Detroit and Houston, and then get placed in strategic jobs that become multinational with a lot of German money. And there are people that came in like Peter Drucker and Fritz Kramer and Henry Kissinger, and this now we have the ambassador to Chile and the CIA, Mr. Landau, who is so important in this story of these death squads in South America, who came from Vienna and came to the United States, and they put on American uniforms. The war was over May 8, 1945, but Hitler knew by 1943 that they were going to start all over. And his generals, as I mentioned last week, knew it by 1941. But these people came into the United States from 1943 at the time the Nazis were reorganizing, retrenching, changing their name organizations. And they put on American uniforms like 1944 and with their German and went directly into American intelligence and end up in Europe. Not, you see, the Henry Kissinger fighting the Germans. He sat in a hayloft while these guys froze and were shot at the Ardennes offensive and the Battle of the Bulge. I don't know how much they fought. They were probably doing all the brain work, like Fritz Kramer was traveling all over Europe while the American boys were dying. And then the war was over. They have this big powwow at Omer Amigau and other places with Klaus Barbie and von Rundstedt and Piper and Dietrich and Kramer and all Hitler's top generals and Otto Skorzeny, and they all have a grand time and a grand reunion, and the former Germans are there to treat them and debrief them and write their histories with them. And then they become high officers in the death squads in Central South America, South Africa, working with Otto Skorzeny, and they came in just as the war was winding down so that their profile says they fought Hitler, but they're already ready to meet the other Germans on terms that they will combine and fight against the Soviet Union. This pattern, once you get aware of the formula, the pattern reappears. So when I read a book, I'm looking up Mr. Slaughterman in a book, and I see that Landau, the ambassador, is from Vienna with this same pattern as Peter Drucker, Fritz Kramer. I take another look, and if I had time in my lifetime to reread the books I have, much less buy the new ones, then these pages would jump at me, and what I just accepted or passed over is not a pertinent part of the story, is a very essential part of the story of what happened to America in the transfer of becoming the Fourth Reich. So that when you go into Grenada with the Nazi helmet and they refer to it as a blitzkrieg, it is in fact a blitzkrieg, just as Hitler had throughout Europe. We'll take a 1 minute break and then get on to some more very important subjects. This is KAZU FM. We'll take 1 minute now.